and welcome to season two of the Your Favorite Band podcast. My name is Brandon. It's so good to be back with you. My buddy Dave is alive. It's been a crazy couple of months. We haven't done a show since August, and we were getting hate mail from our fans being like, where are you? Well, we had good reason. Dave was getting married, and I was having a baby, and booking bands and interviewing them during that season seemed like a pretty dumb thing to do, so we didn't do it. But we're so happy to be back, especially with this episode, which we'll get to in a second. But season two is a new chapter for the Your Favorite Band podcast, and here's why. We could have just kept going and not made seasons, but we decided to change up the format a little bit. In the past, we've just done long-form interviews and just put out the interviews pretty much raw as is, and that's fine. It's wonderful, and I hope that you've liked those episodes. But one thing we want to do going forward is kind of tell the stories in a more unique and storyteller type of way. And what I mean by that is if you've ever listened to This American Life or something like that, it's a story that is told in a really artistic and awesome way. And we want to try to do something like that. And I could think of no one else better to tell a story about than today's guest. Today's guest is the one, the only.
My name is Darren King. I am a producer, drummer. I play guitar and synth. And I am half of a band called Sucre, which is me and my wife. And she's an incredible singer named Stacy, formerly of the family band Isley. And we have two beautiful baby girls. I don't know if I said that. I live in Nashville. And music, that's my thing.
And we're going to do our best to tell Darren's story. Darren's beginnings with drums and the start of Mute Math. And yes, his departure from Mute Math and what he's doing today. We're also going to be premiering a brand new song from Sucre. And if you want to just hear that, you can skip forward to about minute 51. And we'll be playing a brand new song from them. But let's get started. Season 2, Episode 1, Darren King. What better way to start out? This is the Your Favorite Band podcast. Darren King grew up in Marshfield, Missouri, with a dog and a cat, and a dad who had a massive cassette collection. But more on that later. Like a lot of kids growing up, his parents separated when he was 7. And like most kids, this affects him. In fact, Darren finds himself still dealing with the separation today in relation to his wife and 2 kids.
I did something about 3 or 4 months ago. Do you remember when the Super Nintendo Mini came out?
Oh, yeah. I know. I waited in line for that sucker.
Yeah, so did I. I went to Toys R Us, I waited in line, and I am not the kind of guy to do that. I have not played video games in 20 years, but I felt compelled, like I had to do that and get it for my daughter, who's 5, and 4 at the time, and I had to give her that experience. So I of those awesome video games that I had. We don't have any gaming systems. So I waited in line, I got it, I wrapped it, and then I gave it to Scarlett. And as she opened it, I had I started crying because I realized what I had just done. And my parents divorced when I was 7. And the last Christmas we had together was the Christmas where I got the Super Nintendo. And I don't know why it didn't occur to me what I was doing, like what I was like trying to like do or recreate or reclaim, or I don't know, but I got really emotional over a Super Nintendo Mini.
Darren's love for music started at a young age thanks to his dad's cassette collections, and it was in those cassettes that he would first fall in love with the drums.
I would get to hear great music from an early age. I fell in love with the Beach Boys. I fell in love with instrumental surf rock like Pipeline and Wipeout, of course. I specifically remember the Beach Boys. I remember something about Good Vibrations, knowing at a really young age, that's sick. Like, that's a great, that's something special. I didn't know anything about the story of how long he'd worked on it and how much innovation and passion went into that song. But I loved it. And I loved anything percussive. And the moment that did it was Gene Krupa, who's a legendary drummer. I have a picture of him on my wall in my studio. Gene Krupa played for Benny Goodman. And he was this hunk, you know, jet black hair, really, you know, cool looking guy, wild. He was a heroin addict. That part of it's not so admirable. But he was just like the first bad drummer man, you know, and he had his own band. Gene Krupa, he was up there with Lionel Hampton. There's this legendary story of him playing it in Carnegie Hall, in this 9-minute, 10-minute version of it with multiple drum solos. And it's such a sick song with such a cool landscape, all these dips and rises in the dynamics and beautiful solos, like masterful soloing by each individual who plays. And the legend of it was that, you know, people danced in the aisle in Carnegie Hall, which was apparently, up until that point, a place for more highbrow music, and to dance at Carnegie Hall was unheard of. Anyhow, I love that story. I love Gene Krupa. That was a like a linchpin moment for me with drums. I later started to find out about Bjork, Beastie Boys, Beck on my own. In the the 90s, I graduated in 2000. I also went through this phase though, and when I talk about my story, it's going to have to get religious because I was hyper religious. I was extremely religious. I was raised in a charismatic Christian church where they prayed in tongues. And it was really cool being the drummer there because you got to play loud and fast. You know, and people would dance, and it was, you know, it. And sometimes you get to play for a long time at the end of the service. So that's the most formative place and important and meaningful place for me was this church where all my story centered around. But I went through phases. There was a big movement in the 90s of kids throwing away all of their music and listening only to Christian. And I was intense, and I've always been intense. Anything I do, I go too far with it. And I did that with this, with throwing away my secular CDs. Everyone else was throwing away their secular CDs, so I threw away my Christian ones too and only listened to worship music. It had to be church music. It couldn't be DC Talk. I threw that away too, you know? That wasn't good enough, you know? So I was this hyper-religious kid through the majority of my teens. And I can talk about that more in a little bit, but that frames a lot of my identity to this day. And I'm still sorting through dealing with the person that I am because of how I viewed the world when I was 14 and 17, you know?
Most people know Darren from his time with Mute Math, but growing up, Darren was like most kids in 1989. He wanted to be like Mike, and that desire to be like Michael Jordan would be what would eventually drive him to learn the drums.
I had all these basketballs, and I was awful. I couldn't believe that no matter how much energy or how hard I worked, I never got better at basketball. You know, there was never a return on the investment of practice for me. So I aired out the basketballs to different sounds, like boop, 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 to the lowest, and then I pushed my mattress off of my bed by about a foot, and I used the metal frame of the box spring, and I sat cross-legged, and I would drum on my four basketballs with my box frame as my hi-hat for hours. That was my first drum set.
And it was from there that Darren would begin to fall in love with the drums. And anyone who's listened to Mute Math for any period of time knows that Darren has a very distinct drum sound, a sound that he began crafting early on.
I think my style started to develop when I found out about sample-based music and learned about DJ Shadow. Beck is another one Beastie Boys also. Diggable Planets. I found a Diggable Planets record, Blowout Combs, at the thrift store in Marshfield, Missouri. And that has Zigaboo on it. It has this sample of Here Come the Meter Men. And so I started figuring out. There's a beautiful thing, I think, that happens, you know, in music like DJ Shadows, whenever it's sort of a mosaic of older styles and different records that get recorded in different places at different times that are added together. And I think when creating that kind of music, you can kind of step away from it and come back to it as you're working on it. So I learned about the loop, you know, I learned about Earl Palmer, all those, you know, Bernard Purdy. And as I started to develop a style, I was trying to emulate those drummers for David Axelrod. But then I also had this white boy aggression thing. Like, I had all this pent up, you know, all that stuff that happens when you grow up, you know, in the middle of nowhere, and it's real quiet. I love, there's a quote Elliot Smith has that says, someone asked him one time, why is your music so quiet? And he said, when you grow up with screaming in your home, the last thing you want is screaming in your music. And my experience has been very much the opposite, is that I think all of my drumming was because it was way too quiet. It was just me. I'd get home from school, I'd be alone. My mom would still be a couple hours before she'd get home from work. And I needed noise. And I was hyper. This is a sort of hyper annoying, ultra Christian kid. And I had, if I didn't have my dog Henry, Australian Shepherd, and the drum set to go hit, I don't know, I would have been in a whole, you know, I would have been in a mess. You know, I've been a troubled kid. So it was a big part of that, man. It's like, so it's some hybrid between that. I don't, you know, when I realized I play hard, you know, I used to break bass drum pedals on tour. You're playing too hard if you're doing that. I mean, that's nothing to be proud of. I call that gorilla foot in drummer community. If you have gorilla foot, which I used to have a really big case of. I break my knuckles, not break, but you know, you could bloody and cut up and break sticks, break heads, everything. And I was just like working out some stuff, man. So there's some halfway point between a funky drummer and angry drummer, and that's where I'm at, you know. And I'm less angry. I still get worked up. But you can drum hard when you're happy too, right?
This funky, angry drummer would eventually find his way to a guy named Paul Meany, and it was that meeting that would, after a long, weird journey, create Mute Math.
I met Paul in April of 1997. He was an intern for this evangelist named Donnie McGuire, who has an insane story. And Reba and Donnie McGuire, if you ever look them up, they are Southern gospel legends whose life is stranger than fiction times 100 of all the experiences that they've had. Everything from, like, you know, getting death threats from the KKK for having black background singers to touring Vietnam during the war and performing for, like, they're just crazy. Their story is crazy. So they would do is they would travel through America, pick up young people who just got out of high school and who were good at music, and that would be their band. So Reba and Donnie went through New Orleans, picked up these two guys, Adam and Paul, who sang. And then their next stop was Springfield, Missouri, at my church, Cornerstone. And they would do this thing where they would they'd do these revival services where you'd have church every night for 10 weeks is what they did. So I saw them. I saw Paul and Adam for 10 weeks straight. And they came in, and they would rap and sing. And I would get to drum along and play percussion, and we would do like Christian versions of secular songs. And it was such an exciting moment in my life, right? It was very much a, you know, like I wanted to be, it was probably the moment where I felt that I more drawn to music than I did to being a minister, you know, or a preacher. And I kept in touch with Paul. And the day I graduated high school in June of 2000, I flew down to New Orleans to join his band, Earth Suit, who had just gotten signed to Sparrow, a Christian record label. And there was all this expectation and excitement behind Earth Suit. And they were going to do a lot of touring. And the record came out in June 20th of 2000. And I toured with them for about a month and a half. The term they used was percussion intern. I was interning in the band. As like a nice way of saying, we're not paying you, right? So I was the intern. And basically, what it really was an audition. You know, it was a two-month, it was a tour-long audition that I failed. I didn't make the cut. They already had an amazing drummer in Hutch. And they didn't need me on djembe. I had brought this djembe that I had decoupaged. I still have it up here in my studio. They didn't need me. And so they sent me back home. They said, sorry, Darren, you didn't make the cut. And I was brokenhearted. I was so devastated. I went and did one semester of community college. Knowing the whole time, I didn't want to go to college or community college. I only wanted to do music. So then I got a phone call from Donnie McGuire, the same guy that Paul and Adam had interned for so long ago. And Donnie was getting off of the road, and he was going to settle down and start a church. My church had kind of gone through a big scandal, and I was really disillusioned and hurt. And I needed distance at that time from all that because I was very, very, like, just wigged out. I didn't know what to think. Up was down was up for me. My whole world had gotten turned around. But I needed out of Missouri at that time in my life. I needed to you know, branch out badly enough that I was more than glad to go work at this church and drum there. And so I moved to Nashville. And I had an apartment there with the other guy who worked for Reba and Donnie. His name is David. And David was from Sierra Vista, Arizona. And he was this delightful guy who could fix anything. He could fix anything. He'd never really gone to school much, but he was the most practically gifted, handy dude. And he was a good guy. He always talked in sound effects. And he was my first roommate. And I lived there with him for a year, and we worked for this church. And that was a very innocent but happy time for me. You know, I remember that was me being 18 years old living in Nashville. Sadly, David died in a motorcycle crash over a decade ago. I really regret that in the years after living with him that we didn't hang out more and didn't stay in touch better. I always put it off like I you know, Dave and I will hang again and but I was too busy. And so I miss him. I remember that time so fondly where I had two keys. I had a house key to my apartment. I had a key to my apartment. I had a key to my car, and I had one bill, and it was a phone, you know, it was a $60 phone bill. And I worked at this other banquet hall, and I would just get all the leftover food. It was such a simple, beautiful time in my life with so few obligations and the whole world ahead of me. And I remember being so freaked out that I didn't know who my girlfriend was going to be. I didn't know when my life was going to take off. And I wish I could go back and tell that kid, like, it's fine, just enjoy this, you know, like, chill, man. But I remember feeling really trapped, like lost and like I didn't have anything, you know. Everything I owned could fit in a car, right? Then I got this call to go play drums for a rap group named Ill Harmonics. They offered for me to come along for a month. And the bass player was Roy from Earth Suit. Later, Roy Mutemath. Earth Suit had a month break and, you know, Roy was going to join that tour. So I got to tour with them, and that was my first tour ever, was playing in this hip-hop band. It was my first paying gig, was playing for this hip-hop group. And a cool thing is that all these years later, I'm about to go do a show, a solo show, and I know we'll talk about this later, but I'm going to do a solo show in Dallas, and Doug, the MC from that group, who's one of my favorite rappers, he's an insane rapper, he goes by Crum now, K-R-U-M, is going to come join me. He's going to come join me on stage. No to censor, hope you get more out of my rhyming than Simon saying drive a 6-4, that's why I lick more, shots in the air is a flare, you gotta wake up and prepare. Is a one and it seems right, awakening your spirit so that you can see. I gotta make music that, and then I rejoined Earth Suit when Hutch left. And there's another great drummer who filled in for a while in between that time named Adam Wordzik. And then I auditioned. I had been practicing a lot. I had taken lessons from Yanni's drummer, and I took lessons from him for a little bit, and I had been practicing drums. It was my job to clean the church. So I'd clean the church, and then I would set up my drum set, because they had electronic drums at that church. I would set up my drum set, and I would sometimes just sleep in the church. I would drum until I'd get so tired, and then I'd put a bunch of like little workout mats that the kids would play on. Like I'd stack them up, I'd sleep on that, and then I'd go to work at Ruth's Chris, and just not even bother to go back to the apartment that I lived at. And that was this season of my life where I slept in a church and played drums. And it was fun. That's when I got good. That's when I became good enough to play shows. Like prior to that, I was it was a little iffy on the timing. Like Roy as a bass player is the tightest. Like he has, like, you know how people have perfect pitch? I feel like Roy has perfect time. And playing along with him taught me how to lock in, because he wouldn't wiggle with me. Like he wouldn't waver a lot to try and follow me. He would be like, nope, I'm playing tight. I'm gonna play the bass tight, and you can either play with me or you can sound off. And he would play tight and lock in. And then I learned from that hip hop tour how to lock in, you know, with Roy. And then Earth Suit got dropped from their label, and everybody left except for me, essentially. And Paul and I lived at Paul's house in Mandeville, Louisiana, and I worked then at a macaroni grill as a waiter. And that is when we started Math. We initially thought that we were just going to do I don't know, like we were going to be Neptunes, you know, we were just going to be producers and make music for other people. And that's whenever I started going to concerts in New Orleans. I saw so many important shows. That's where I got to see a band called Moom from Iceland, M-U-M. I saw Mr. Quintron. I saw Lightning Bolt. I saw Godspeed You Black Emperor. I saw all these incredible live shows, and that was absolutely one of the coolest seasons of my life, looking back on it. Still single, still not a girlfriend, you know, not even, I mean, I would hang out with, you know, with groups of people, and I'd hang out with a girl every now and then, but I was like I wasn't there. Like my mind was not on getting into a serious relationship. I wanted to be in music at that time. And so that's Math quickly turned into and evolved into Mute Math.
And it didn't take long for Mute Math to take off. Their single Typical would garner a lot of attention thanks to a backwards music video, and Mute Math would take the road and quickly gain a good following thanks to their energetic live shows and their self-titled debut album.
The excitement to make a great live show happened kind of naturally and sort of grew out of Paul and I feeding off of each other's excitement and energy for a good idea. And we did always try to max out the budget and all of the resources at hand to try and create as good of a live experience as we could. I remember whenever we wanted to do video, and I remember whenever we toured that first tour. That's, you know, looking back on it all now, the first album and the tours affiliated with that first record are the most special and meaningful time. I've asked myself lately, why is the first Mute Math record the best one? And what was it about it that's so special? What was it about that time? And what did we capture? And there are a few things. One is just your first record. So we had all the time leading up to it, all those years to create and prep for it. And then also, I think Ted T, the producer, was the right fit. And then I think there was just all this youthful energy and focus put into it. And I remember that the excitement for that just spilled into then the music videos and the energy to try and go for broke for the live show. I remember always, like, a lot of what we did was very held together by duct tape and like stuff you get from Home Depot. We tried to make it look as professional as possible, but it was always, you know, pretty jerry-rigged. And we toured with those fluorescent lights. Jeff, who did all of our production from the entire inception of the band, Jeff, we first met with him, Jeff Lava, who I still work with and is still a great friend. He came to us like, okay, I've got this idea. We'll do fluorescent lights behind you. And then we thought we could smash them. Not thinking about, you know, how toxic is this that every night we're just throwing a bunch of cymbals and stuff into... They're just releasing a bunch of mercury into the air, right? You know, into a small venue where, like, Jackrabbits in Jacksonville. You know, we're at these small clubs that are poorly ventilated, and we're just releasing. And for the grand finale, mercury, you know, like, just released into... It's really dumb. You know, I look back on, like, how inefficient we were often, and how much better we got as we got older and learned stuff about how to do stuff faster. But... kind of made up for it because we just had all that energy to work hard with. I look back on that time and that season, and it was like real life happened. A lot of life. Have you ever had a year like that where you feel like 10 years happened in one? And then you have years where nothing, you know, whole years of your life where nothing much to report. You know, I don't know, like whole years you don't remember too well because it just wasn't too eventful. You can't pinpoint anything in particular that you know happened when you were that age. But oh man, that was it. Like that first, when that first record came out, that was a crazy season. Yeah, special. It was beautiful. It was really a cool time that I really am thankful. We worked so hard all the time. You know, whenever we would take breaks, and we would take lengthy breaks, you know, lengthy time off. But whenever we worked really hard, and we had an insane work ethic. And the show was just our favorite part, right? Everything else was to get there. So that was the part there was at least all this fresh energy and excitement for. And we were proud of being known as a good band. We always had disproportionately far more ticket sales than record sales. You know, bands that were drawing as many people as we were to a live show were selling a lot more records at that time than we were. And so we just knew that that was special and important, and we loved it. And we had always tried to make it memorable. And we'd see another band that had a great live show, and we would feel competitive, or we would try to emulate something about what they did well in our own way. And yeah, I mean, there were a lot of tours where we just put all the effort, energy, and money into the production and making it this crazy thing, and we'd go for broke, you know. And I'm proud of those. I'm proud of that DVD. Like, that's another thing that I'm really proud of is the Live at the Tabernacle DVD that we did, which I think was after Odd Soul. Yeah, that was a good show and a good era. Like, that was a really good time, personally and also in the band. So yeah, that was very evident that we were a good live band, that we were nuts and we would go hard. It was never something I tried to do. I didn't try to tell myself, hey, come on, man, drum harder, get into this. Like, mentally, if anything, I would have to put on the brakes because I would get so hyped up. I told you I'm kind of intense, and I go hard, you know, in life and with stuff. And drumming was a place that I felt really comfortable with that. It was a place in my life where I could, where that was allowed and accepted, and it felt right to hit stuff really hard. And when people were there and I would just get hyped up, I always remember my favorite parts in the shows were the parts that I kind of got to close my eyes and play a loop, play something that was kind of like a mantra. And I would sometimes even have words in my head that would coincide with the beat and be something like a little rap that I would say over and over again, whether that was a prayer or a thought to myself. And I would start saying that over and over again and in my head. And then start drumming in. And that, those would become transcendent experiences. Sort of that out-of-body thing would happen. Other times, you don't feel it at all, and you just know that you're doing your job. You know, people came, and they paid to see you do your thing, and you better do a great job, because it's what you do. And so I remember that. That's a lesson I learned in church, because I was really scared. I had this pressure that you had to feel God's presence. That was something really like was worried about, that if you didn't feel it, you were sinning. That if you were really a good person, you would be aware of his presence at all times. And anytime you weren't, you were being a bad person. And there was this book called The Practice of the Presence of God. It's a good book, but I thought that it meant that you had to be that way. You had to always feel good. You would always feel this celestial feeling. And I would go up to the music leader and he's like, and I'd say, hey, I've got to confess, I'm not really feeling the thing. I'm not feeling that presence. Should I quit? Like, should I step down? Do I need to quit this? You know, like, is that okay for me to be up here? And he goes, yeah. He laughed. He's like, yeah, man, you're doing a job. You know, you're doing the work. And so that became something I took with me for the rest of my life, is whenever I get up on stage, I'm doing what I do, whether I feel good or not.
Anyone who's listened to Mute Math's discography knows that no Mute Math album is like the other, and they constantly evolve and push themselves musically. And that's thanks to the way that Paul and Darren would write and create music.
I had an instrument called an ASR-10. It was made by Ensoniq. Paul had one as well, and it's a legendary, you know, sampler. It, you know, that like a lot of the, pretty much all the hip hop music from the golden era was either made on an MPC or an ASR. The MPC has the drum pads, the ASR is a keyboard, and it was, you know, a big deal because it had, I think, if I remember correctly, 16 megabytes of memory in it that you could sample with. Or you, maybe you could max it out to 32, I can't remember. But it equaled about 200 seconds of sample time. And so I would emulate DJ Shadow Records, and I would chop up samples either of, you know, live instruments or most of the time my record collection. And that's where most Mute Math songs started, was in my ASR-10. Or Paul would bring a song idea, but I think more often than not, he would write to some sequence that I made. So I have all these sequences, all these floppy disks and then zip disks here up in my studio with all the original ideas. And oftentimes, what the song became didn't resemble much of my track. Sometimes it was very similar. And then we would go through this reverse engineering process of jamming on it, recording that, and then playing on it again. It wasn't until the third record, maybe a little bit in Armistice, that I felt confident enough to play instruments other than drums. But for the most part, my tools were electronics and sampling, and then I would replace the samples, you know. Oftentimes, rather than clear them, we would just redo them, and that's where I got good at redoing stuff and trying to emulate. Well, I wonder what kind of mic, what type of amp, what type of, you know, stuff was used to make this originally. And so, yeah, I mean, for all those Mute Math songs, there are all these correlating tracks and things that were our initial inspiration and where we started with. And our process was long. We would spend months, we'd spend a month on one song and then scrap it, you know, and then start over. It was really laborious, super long hours, and a lot of input. Like the input to output ratio, you know, like we would work for a really long time on stuff. And, you know, I can look back on that and it hurts, like, to think about, you know, like you save up in Logic, you save up. And I remember some songs I'd save up and like save up version number 123, you know? And like that was Burden. I remember doing that at Ted's studio. I remember Burden and then typing in 120 something and thinking, this is not how it's supposed to be. You know, like this is not how you're supposed to feel like this. And
so that's why there was 4 years between Odd Soul and Vitals.
Absolutely. Yeah, we were busting our asses the whole time. Yeah, and you, at a certain point, you realize that the result is not a Sistine Chapel. You know, you're making pop music. So, you know, I think we got way more efficient on both, with each album. After Armistice was the worst. Armistice got really dark because we had all this pressure we put on ourselves to, had all this momentum from the first record and all this positivity, and we way took ourselves too seriously.
Was that put on yourself or from labels or what?
Yeah, this is all self. Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's labels there too, and there are all those people, but it's up to you. I mean, we were grown-ups, you know, so yeah, we did that ourselves. That pressure to you know, like make the great American novel, you know? And I've learned a lot about how not to do that and how that's not the way you live. It's not the way you create. You make a record. And a record is just that. It's a recording. It's a document of a season. And if you go past too many seasons, it gets diluted. And you need to just make a record of this event. Make a record of this year. Make a record of these 2 years. Make a record of this season. And yeah, maybe sometimes people make a record of a decade in their lives, but that's hard to do, you know, or to make a record that encompasses a 5 year period. And I have a lot of friends. I have a lot of creative friends who I see them doing that. I have a couple in particular that come to mind where I worry about them. I'm like, man, are you ever going to put this record out? Are you ever going to actually just call this done? You know, they can't believe you are still going. I mean, I remember with Armistice, our A&R guy, Perry, legendary A&R guy. I signed Radiohead, signed Muse, signed Damien Rice. He's this awesome. He told us, he was so stressed out and so fed up. He goes, a record is done when you either run out of money or you just run out of time. And you guys are so out of both and you're still just going full speed. And we're like, and we went on for a year after that, you know, making that record. So that was dark. That was a tough time. Yeah, that was a hard one. I still like a lot of the songs. I like Pins and Needles and I like Clipping. I like some of the songs on that. But it was brutal. That was a brutal season. The only good part of that season and what kept me alive was I had started dating Stacy. And I was in Oxford, Mississippi. We were recording the album there. And I would drive on the weekends to Tyler, Texas, and then drive through the night back to Oxford, Mississippi to continue working on the record. So it was weird how there was this, the band was at an all-time dark point for me. But my personal life, there was this glimmer, you know, there was this good thing happening.
Four albums in and one on the way, coming off a huge tour with one of the biggest bands in the world in 21 Pilots, Mute Math seemed to be in a really good place heading into their fifth studio album, Play Dead. That is, until August 8th happened. A note appeared on the Mute Math Facebook page stating that Darren would be leaving the band, and while Darren wasn't able to go into much detail about what happened or why he left, he did have one thing to say.
I don't regret leaving, and I wish I had sooner. I wish I had a lot sooner, and I can't tell you exactly when it should have been. I can either tell you that I wish I'd left sooner, or I wish that I had conducted myself very differently within the band and in my personal life, just with what happens to you whenever you turn 30. And all of a sudden, you're supposed to crush it, right? There's this pressure that you're in your prime. You've got children now, and you're trying to hold it all together. And you're married, and then you're trying to still have this adolescent dream of your rock band. And I look back on how hard I worked in my brain to create this workaround that it was okay, and that I was okay, and that Stacy was fine. She got, you know, she stayed at home but didn't have to work, even though she had to quit her band. And we moved to Nashville. We were following these life choices, trying to figure out how to find our own thing. I look back on the 5 years that she spent in the early parts of our marriage waiting, you know, waiting on me and me telling her someday it'll be worth it. Just hold on. It'll be, you know, I know it's hard right now, but it's coming, you know, that and that day, like, what is that? When is that day? 5 years later? Well, you know, someday it's going to feel like this was, you know, worth the sacrifice. And the longer and longer I soldiered on, just the less that became believable. And there's so much more to it. The only thing I will also say is that all of that kind of stuff, bands break up all the time. And even though Paul and I are not speaking, I wish him well. I hope he's very successful. And I know that he will be. I know that he's the hardest working, one of the most talented people you'll ever find. And I know he's going to do a great job. And I suppose for fans who I know were disappointed that I left right before we, you know, we're about to do a bunch of touring and right before a record that we had written and produced for a long time was coming out. The only hope silver lining is that perhaps now there'll be even more music, right, as each individual member is working on stuff. Hopefully there'll be more music and more good music. I'm currently working on all kinds of stuff. I'm having a really hard time because I'm completely independent. It was hard. I mean, that was the toughest part about quitting in the manner that I did and when I did was that I, you know, had to lose my relationship with Mutemath's manager. You know, I no longer work with Mutemath's booking agent. All that business part of it, because those are awesome people, really, really great people who do really, really good work. And, you know, so now I'm self-managed, asking for favors, asking all my manager friends whom I trust for advice. And they're all telling me like, yeah, well, it's hard, right? Yeah. And, but I'm also at the same time so thrilled to finally have autonomy and to get to decide the who, what, where, when, why, and how of what I'm attempting to do and what it's worth to me. And I get to push the gas or the brake pedal along with Stacy. And if she's telling me, Darren, this is getting really unhealthy, that I don't have to, like, we could just stop anytime. And I think that was an important moment in my life. And I'm not proud, you know, I for doing the thing that I wish I had done so many years later, right whenever it's, you know, almost too late. But I'm glad I did. And that's why I feel like I'm at 35, and there's been this part of me like, are you washed up? You know, there's this pressure that you're coolest when you're 18. You peak at 23 in your coolness. And I think you don't. I don't think you have to. Or even if you do, who cares? You know, and then there's all this pressure of what you were supposed to be or could have been or could have accomplished. What your potential is, and did you live up to it? And that's a big thing that, you know, when I go back to the religion thing for me, that I, from a very early day, I have all this guilt and pressure and stuff that I dealt with from an early age, that I was supposed to be a legend, right? That Jesus said, greater works than me shall you do, right? And then he raised some dead people, right? And so I believed that when I was a kid. I believed that those guys were perfect, that they were asexual, you know, that they just didn't do anything. And that they healed people, and that they saved people, you know, that everything they did was selfless, and that I needed to be that way. And whenever I failed, it hurt really bad to realize how bad I was. And there was all that guilt and all that. And that transferred into music for me. Like, okay, you're not going to be a prophet, but you're going to be a musician. So you better be a legend. And there, like, should be a statue, and you need to be all this, and you should be great. And no matter how what it costs, you know, you got to become great. No, you don't. No, I don't. I don't. I do what I can. I do what I can. I got kids, you know. I mean, I think about, like, all these legendary movies. I see a correlation, right, with Ray Charles and then the Johnny Cash movie that these guys idolize. And one thing that's sort of a thread that goes through them is that they were just awful, seemingly. I mean, I don't know for sure, but they were just awful to their families, right? And there's a point at which I had to accept and come to grips with the fact that that's me. I'm doing a bad job. I'm not being a good enough husband. I'm not being a good enough dad. And to the point where my daughter said to me, she was four at the time, "Daddy, I need you to slow down." And I wanted to tell her, "I need you to not talk like you're 20. I need you." So, you know, that's it, man. And, you know, sucked to leave everybody hanging, you know, but I was in a double bind but at the same time, if I'm honest with you, man, I don't miss it. I did while they were out touring and I was at home. That was hard. I couldn't be on Instagram, you know, like that sucked, you know, to miss out on that, because I love touring. But also, I still had a beautiful time. It was a beautiful time in my life that I don't regret missing. I would have regretted missing out on.
Darren is now 35 and beginning to embark on his own journey as a drummer-DJ combo, creating amazing collaborations of songs and loops and samples all set to visuals. The question you have after seeing it is, how in the world did he come up with it?
I started doing, like, as a hobby for fun, because I told you, you know, all of my early creative process was all derivative style works, like DJ Shadow. So I wanted to be DJ Shadow, and I wrote music that way. And that's how Mute Math Music was written. It was like we'd make these DJ Shadow songs, and then we would turn them into live band music. You know, so I'd make these mosaics out of my record collection on the sampler, and then we would reinterpret them as a live band. And then I just thought it'd be fun as a hobby to start finding the connecting points, right? There are all these, there's a lot of math to music as well. You know, there's the circle of fifths, and then there's also with BPMs, there's a point at which, you know, there's polyrhythms, you know, there's a point at which a triplet intersects with quarter notes at different BPMs, all that. And in your record collection, if you start putting those songs into Logic or putting in your whatever workstation you use, you start chopping them up and playing with them, you find those intersecting points, right? And it is really cathartic. I don't know why, it's really fun to find out that, oh wow, the vocal for this is like the relative minor for this other really dope song, and it creates this whole different color to the melody whenever they're played together. And that just became a hobby. And then I started making a little, you know, 15 and 20 minute thing out of that, and then I just decided to drum on it. And I don't know where or when I got up the courage. I owe it to Lindsay, Mute Math's manager, for helping me get that show in New York and having the courage to attempt to do that. And for getting that show for me at the Mercury Lounge. So that was it. You know, I got offered to go play Seth Meyers' show for a week, filling on drums. And we just decided to have a show. One of the nights, because, you know, they film those TV shows during the day. So I did a show at the Mercury Lounge, and a lot of my friends came out, a lot of great people came, and it was really, and it felt good to be nervous, because I didn't get nervous for Mute Math shows, because I had played like a couple thousand of them, you know? I don't know how many, but I just never got nervous for a Mute Math show. It felt like second nature. But I got nervous again for this show, and I couldn't tell you how cool it felt to be nervous. And yeah, that was such a revelation. So I'm about to do a few more of those, and the goal is for it to, I mean, I have a lot of tracks. I have a lot of songs that never became Mute Math songs, and I have a lot of just unfinished song ideas, and so I'm sorting through those, and my dream would be to make an album at least, you know, an EP, a star, or some singles that follow in the vein of like that Uncle record DJ Shadow made, UNKLE Uncle, that first one that all the great, like, has Rabbit in Your Headlights on it with Tom York, and then Drums of Death, and then or like a Gorillaz record. Yeah, maybe that's a better reference point. Something like a Gorillaz record that has lots of vocalists and sounds like it has lots of references, but that they work together, you know. And so I'm currently hunting for vocalists in my spare time. I am, you know, currently doing a lot of just work, music work, to keep the lights on, you know, here, and pay for the diapers and whatnot. But whenever I get free time, I'm working on putting together original tracks. And I have one. I have this one track, and I think I found the vocalist for it. He's supposed to do some vocals next week, and I'll release that as a first single. And so the idea is that hopefully the my solo set will start to incorporate original music.
But that is not all that Darren is working on. Darren's wife, Stacy, of the Isley fame, have a project called Sucre.
Well, Sucre became an experiment in happiness, I think. And that's what we were trying to do, almost like cross-training. You know, whenever you're in your downtime, instead of doing something entirely unrelated, you do another similar but different thing, because that's what you love to do and you want to regain the joy of it. And I remember working on the first Sucre. We didn't plan to make a record. All we planned to do was make something where we weren't worried about money. There was no record label, nobody telling us that it had to be a hit or it needed to fit in a certain format. And we wanted to only make something that we loved. And so it was Stacy, Jeremy, and me. We drive up to Springfield, Missouri, where Jeremy...
A lot of times, like around the holidays, because that's the only time Darren had off and wasn't touring. So.
Yeah, it'd be like twice...
Around Christmas.
Yeah, it'd be like my birthday in June, and then Christmas. We would go up to Missouri and spend a week or two, and we'd go work with Jeremy in his awesome studio on Commercial Street in Springfield, Missouri. And that is such a beautiful, happy memory in my life. And it was a moment where I learned how it's supposed to feel. We use the term play music. And I learned a little bit about, yeah, play. This is supposed to be really fun most of the time. It's hard work, but we also, you know, but there was so much less pressure around it. And I'm not saying this as like a backhanded thing about Mute Math. I'm talking about myself here, okay? I'm talking about my... Like, because I have a lot of really happy memories in Mute Math, a lot of really fun things, and a lot of things I'm proud of that we accomplished too. So all I'm saying is, like, I learned a little bit about myself, about what the creative process feels like when it's healthy.
And that brings us to the premiere of a brand new Sucre song, Inside. But before we play it, Darren and Stacy take us behind the scenes into the writing of the song and what it means.
To me, it's about the first year that you're married. And you... have all these
expectations, yeah,
these hopes, and you have all of your habits, traditions, plans,
and your brattiness.
Yeah, my brattiness. And you like you know that famous Mike Tyson quote, right? And this is figurative. Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth, right? Like life, marriage, and suddenly life hits you.
Yeah,
and it hits you together, and you're stuck, you know, and
crazy,
you know. And we had a rough first year, and I think that a lot of the songs that we've written and produced lately carry that in it, that sorrow of the hard part of being married and surviving it. And so that's what the song's about, you know. To me.
Tell me if you disagree.
You wrote the lyrics. I just made the track, and she wrote the lyrics. And it started off with this bass line that she made in Logic.
Beginning.
Yeah. And then I redid it on a Moog and beefed it up.
Yeah, this one where you, like, it was a completely different song.
Yeah.
And I had to kind of go, okay, well, go ahead. Like, give it a shot.
You were skeptical about it. Because, and the
change
reason...
Change it.
I changed the chorus totally. I took it to a darker place. Yeah. Partly because the chords were similar to a previous song we had. And also just because I was feeling it. And I remember I played the track for her, and I was so pumped on it. And then she goes, you really changed a lot of my stuff, you know?
Yeah. I was just like, I don't know, this is kind of super jammy. I don't know if I'm going to be able to ride over it, but I'll give it a shot. And I ended up just having so much fun.
She murdered it, is what she did. Yeah, she killed it.
Riding to it.
And this is like something that happens. Sometimes I will make a song, make a little instrumental, then I'll go watch the kids, and she'll just go sing up in the attic, and then I'll come back, and there's just this song there with the words, with like the melody, with like harmony. And it's not, she just goes to town, and like,
I think it's because I have so much pent up. Just being a mom, I don't really get to do, like, I used to, when I was growing up, I would just do music every day for hours. I would be in my room writing, you know, up until like having kids. And so I think for me, it's just whenever I get the opportunity, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, it's just all this comes flooding out because it's been pent up, kind of thing.
I'm Darren.
Hi, I'm Stacy.
We are Sue Craig.
And this song is called Inside.
Websites, I guess, to keep in mind are dkdrummer.com, dkdrummer.com and then sucreband.com.